Good afternoon and welcome to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. This is Kathleen McCoy, and I'm joined today by co-host Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. Today is our 11th edition of Justice Alaska. Our topic is Senate Bill 91, the criminal justice reform bill that passed with bipartisan support in both the House and Senate last year. It is based on research by the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, which eventually recommended 21 changes to our criminal justice processes. The goal of SB 91 is to reduce recidivism. Two-thirds of Alaska prisoners are back in jail within 3 years. And to more effectively spend state money. SB 91 focuses prison time on the most serious and violent criminals and directs more dollars toward rehabilitation and mental health services. The new law is controversial, and already the Alaska legislature is considering modifications. They were recommended by the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission and are contained in Senate Bills 54 and 55. We'll talk about those changes later in the program. Before I introduce my co-host, Judge Andrews, we will introduce today's guests. And we introduce today's guests. Let me remind listeners that we really welcome your participation in this show with your questions and thoughts about these reforms. So in Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8433. Statewide, it is 1-888-353-5752. And, of course, we'd welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So, Elaine, to you.
All right. Well, today we have a really interesting program and two highly capable experts in the area. I'm going to be taking a back seat because I'm as interested to learn as the listening public. And I'm going to have them introduce themselves. Let me begin with Suzanne.
Good afternoon. My name is Suzanne DiPietro. I am the director of the Alaska Judicial Council, and in that role, I help the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission with its work, including mostly research support. So, speaking here as a staff person for the Criminal Justice Commission.
Thank you.
And this is John Skidmore. I'm the director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. I've been a prosecutor for about 20 years and had the privilege to work in Kenai, Dillingham, Bethel, Anchorage, doing property and violent crimes before special prosecutions, and then finally into the director's position. And my role related to this is that I've been one of the primary advisors to the Attorney General, first Craig Richards, and now Jonna Lindemuth, who hold seats on the Criminal Justice Commission.
Okay, great. So we wanted to start with a little bit of history on SB 91, right?
Right, and so we probably should turn to
the experts,
to the experts and to the research.
Who've lived the history.
Yes, the research arm. And maybe, Suzanne, you can tell us a little bit about this legislation, how it came to be, maybe a little bit about the history of the movement of criminal justice reform.
Sure. So before I talk a little bit about the legislation, I want to tell you just a bit about the Criminal Justice Commission. So the Criminal Justice Commission was created by the legislature in 2014, and the legislature did that, I think, because they had concerns about the criminal justice system, its efficiency, its effectiveness, and also the cost. So the legislature asked the commissioners to come up with recommendations to improve the criminal justice process very broadly. And I just want to say a couple words about who's on the commission. Mr. Skidmore mentioned that the Attorney General's on the commission, also Commissioner of Corrections and Commissioner of Department of Public Safety, so top law enforcement officials in the state, legislative representation, representation from the Alaska Native community, also from victim services. There's a victim services seat on the commission. Also, the Mental Health Trust Authority is represented on the commission. So it's really a very broad perspective of lots of people who work in and around the criminal justice system. So the commission did a lot of studying of the system, kind of what worked and what didn't. It also called in research from other states in the nation. So there are actually, Alaska is not at all the first that's done criminal justice reform. There have been a number of other states who've done it quite successfully. And the commissioners found, as Kathleen McCoy alluded to, that our outcomes weren't very good. About 2 out of every 3 people who are released from prison end up back in prison within 3 years. That doesn't seem like a very good outcome. And most importantly, the commission found that our prison population was really growing fast, a lot faster than the population, and that this was costing a lot of money. And there was even some concern that Alaska was going to need to build a new prison, which would be very costly. So those two things, not getting very good outcomes for our criminal justice dollar and really escalating costs of incarceration, the commission came up with 21 recommendations. And we're going to talk about those recommendations, but they eventually became the basis for legislation that we refer to as SB 91. And the purpose of those two of the recommendations really twofold. First of all, to reduce recidivism, in other words, to get those get better outcomes, and also hopefully to contain the rising cost of incarceration.
Good. Okay, so did the commission draft an SB 91 stands for Senate Bill 91, which is the Criminal Justice Reform Act. So when we talk about SB 91, we're talking about this really quite large legislative packet. So how did that come to be? Who put it together?
Well, that's right. So the commission itself came up with these 21 consensus recommendations, I should add. I think the commission is very proud of the fact that what it the reforms that it recommended to the legislature, it did by consensus. And those reforms, those 21 ideas about how to do better, were drafted into legislation by using the normal legislative drafting process. And also, folks should know that other ideas were put into SB 91 as well that weren't commission recommendations. So the bill itself is quite long. It's around 122 pages. And there are a lot of ideas in there. All 21 of the commission's consensus recommendations show up in there as changes to the laws. And in addition, there are some other ideas that are in the bill as well.
Okay, and let me ask John, were you a participant in getting that legislation passed? What role did you play, and if any, in terms of having this legislative packet reviewed by the legislature?
The legislative process is one that oftentimes calls upon different administrative officials to come and provide comment during legislative hearings. And there were a number of legislative hearings that I was asked to provide testimony where I answered questions of legislators. It's not really my role to carry it forward. And when I go and speak, I'm there speaking on behalf of the administration.
Okay. And so in talking earlier, Suzanne, you said this legislative package, this bill, had an enormous number of hearings.
Yeah, it did. It was pretty thoroughly vetted by the legislators. It had, I believe, over 50 hearings during the legislative process. And I think it's also worth noting that there was a lot of bipartisan support for criminal justice reform. That was true here, and it's been true in other states as well. In fact, there's a great organization, Smart on Crime, that goes around the country and helps states understand how they can reform their criminal justice system to get better outcomes.
Hmm. And can you sort of give us maybe an example of a state that has done this and has had some good results?
Well, the state that we like to point to is Texas. Texas was one of the first. And they had a number of different reforms that they implemented. And again, the idea is, can we use incarceration less as a response? Can we use incarceration more in a more targeted way and not put people in jail, because it's very expensive to put people in jail who don't benefit from jail? And for the ones who don't go to jail, can we do things for them in the community to reform them so that they don't commit more crimes in the future? So Texas had a number of reforms. It reinvested. It had a lot of resources reinvested in the idea of community treatment, supervision in the community, and it did cut its prison population, and the recidivism rate in Texas has gone down. And I should say there are about, I think, 30 states that have decreased their incarceration rates and their crime rates at the same time, which is interesting.
Which is the same goal we're trying to get to here, right? But we've just begun.
Correct.
Yeah. We've got a caller, and I'd like, when they come in, I like to get them on the phone as soon as we can. I'd like to welcome Butch to Justice Alaska. Hi, Butch.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely. What's your question?
Well, I have a question regarding Class B felonies, B as in boy, that are not currently addressed in the SB 54 bill that changes SB 91. And I wanted to ask, Mr. John Skidmore, if he can verify a couple things and maybe elaborate on Class B felonies as far as what the penalties are, and maybe talk about what
he's pulling out his law book.
So it would be Class B felonies would be like assault with a deadly weapon, assault to property damage over $25,000, burning a building down, bribery, escape, forgery, criminally negligent homicide, things like that. And one of the things that I'd like to confirm that I wasn't aware of is that in SB 91 it says Class B felonies would be sentenced to either an SIS, suspended imposition of sentence with no jail, or 0 to 2 years. And the part that I just learned today was that those sentences could be served under administrative parole, and that that person found guilty of that crime could actually serve only a quarter of that, and that could be on an ankle monitor, not in jail. So there's been some confusion on that, and if Mr. Skidmore could kind of clear that up. And then also on a conviction, or maybe I should say a charge.
Why don't we take one at a time? Let's just take one at a time.
I think that's enough.
Okay. So Class B felony, what can we say about what SB 91 actually requires?
So there's a number of subparts to that description. Let me see if I can piece them apart or tease them apart. Let me start with Class B felonies. A Class B felony, some of the examples of the crimes that Mr. Moore gave are accurate Class B felonies. The sentencing ranges for a first-time Class B felony are now 0 to 2 years. So it can be zero time in jail all the way up to 2 years in jail for a first B felony. Then a second B felony has another range that's above that, and then third above that. The maximum for a B felony is 10 years. So to tease some of those other pieces out, one of the first things that was asked about was the ability to have an SIS, or what's called a suspended imposition of sentence. And while it's accurate that many B felonies are eligible for an SIS, there are certain categories of offenses that are not. So, for instance, if it's a crime against a person, like an assault where it involved a firearm, criminally negligent homicide, there are several of those types of crimes that are not eligible for an SIS. And that was the law prior to 91, and there's nothing in 91 that changed that. The second piece I heard was whether or not it was possible to serve any of the sentence on what's called electronic monitoring, or EM, or an ankle monitor. And that's really a determination that's made by the commissioner of the Department of Corrections, who looks at the nature of offense and then decides whether or not it's appropriate for someone to serve their sentence in this other capacity. Nothing in 91 really touched that. And then the last piece that I heard Mr. Moore ask about was administrative parole. And parole is actually what happens after you've already served some portion of your sentence. And I think what he was referring to when he talked about one-third is the concept that's been in Alaska law for quite some time called good time sentencing, where an inmate will serve a certain portion of their sentence, and if they have behaved while they are in prison, then Alaska law allows them to be released on parole before serving the entire sentence. And that means that there are strict conditions on them, and if they violate those conditions, then there's the possibility that they can go back to jail. Now, SB 91 did make some amendments to how parole worked, but I don't think it changed the time at which someone would become eligible for parole, certainly not for a B felony. So those things didn't change, though there are a number of other changes out there that we could probably take the entire hour just to discuss those.
Hmm. Susan, did you want to add anything to that? Nope, you covered it. So Butch, we do have a number of callers, so I'd like to move on if I could. If you've got a succinct question that you can ask next, we can do that, or you should listen, and we'll probably some of our other callers have some of your questions too.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Jean, I'd like to welcome you to Justice Alaska. What's your question?
First of all, I'd like to thank you for doing this program. This is wonderful for to get public input. All right. Here's my question. And actually, before that, I'd like to compliment SB 91 to getting felony DUI back on the road.
Are you on a speakerphone?
Now, yes.
Okay, maybe you can come closer to it so we can hear you. Thanks, Gene. Go ahead.
What I'd like to do is say that Senate Bill 91 was terrific in the sense that it's helping the alcoholic. The alcoholic, alcohol is such a devastating thing to 10% of the population because they can't stop drinking because of the nature of the disease. Senate Bill 91 helps in the sense that it gets people back on the road so they can get to jobs. They don't have to rely on bus or some other means of transportation. So Senate Bill 91 allowing those felony DUIs to drive with ignition control devices or alcohol monitoring devices on the car is terrific because it encourages the alcoholic to not drink as best they can, and it allowed them to work and be productive members of the community. So I just wanted to compliment them on Senate Bill 91 on that change, and I hope there is no attack on that or change on that. So that was my question. Is there anything being attempted to be changed on that area of the law?
Okay, Gene, we'll try to see what we've got on that.
So, Eugene, this is John Skidmore, and the question or the subject you talk about is DUIs and the attempts to prevent people from using their vehicles in a DUI offense. And SB 91 didn't actually change anything with that. Those were laws that were on the books prior. And the new bill that's being looked at in the legislature this year, SB or Senate Bill 54, doesn't in any way touch any of that stuff for DUI offenses. So that which you describe as a very good part in the law remains in the law.
Good.
Okay, one follow-up question. Mr. Skidmore, thank you again for doing this, and you have a wonderful reputation on the community, so appreciate you doing this. I do have a follow-up question. Wellness Court, from my information that has gotten to me, has been terrific in getting people back on the street, the alcoholic, they're trying to be hiding their illness, their disease. Wellness Court is not available in a lot of communities, and Senate Bill 91 allowed those people to get those ignition control devices, even though they did not go to Wellness Court by doing a equivalent program in Palmer, Kenai, those places where there was no Wellness Court. My question is, I think you should look into and would you look into this? In Anchorage, you have Wellness Court, but sometimes attorneys don't steer their client to that, or their client or the person is not willing to do Wellness Court, but do another program that's equivalent. I don't like the idea that in, say, Palmer, that you can get a driver's license if you didn't do Wellness Court, if you did the equivalent. But in Anchorage, you can do the equivalent, but you can't get a work license or a ignition control license.
So is
that
this about SB 91?
Fair to me, John. What do you think?
So again, Eugene, I appreciate your comments there. I think that making sure that folks have the opportunity to seek rehabilitation in all communities across Alaska is very important. And that's certainly one of the things that the commission can take a look at in the future. I don't think 91 addressed a whole lot of that. There were some changes that they made for license revocations and limited license, but the concept of therapeutic courts is certainly something the commission's interested in, and I think most people in Alaska would agree have had very positive impacts. Mm-hmm.
And we have another caller, which I'm going to go to right now. I'd like to welcome Diane onto Justice Alaska. You have a question about rehab and parole board?
Yes, I do. I know from our personal experience in our family that some of the police involved have really lamented SB 91. And I know also that the person involved in the crime against our family may be offered a plea bargain for a Class B felony and potentially 0 to 2 years. Yet, if this person does not get drug and alcohol rehab training and training for what we believe is like fetal alcohol syndrome, that person will be right back in jail. And without proper, really quality rehab, we're just wasting our money by housing and feeding these people repeatedly. So this program you have is long overdue. I think it's really important. And the whole state has been wasting money for years, and I can't believe that Texas is more progressive. So that's one of my concerns. But also, we have personal knowledge of another person who should have been paroled and was not. And I'm wondering, I don't understand how the parole board works and who has oversight over them. But in the case that we know about, it was quite clear that they did not follow the instructions from the judge in this person's case. And they actually contradicted the judge's recommendations or rulings. I'm not sure if they're which one they are. So who is it that makes up this parole board and who has oversight? Because they've really screwed up in one case.
John's going to tackle this, right?
So I'm going to start and then turn it over to Suzanne for the latter part of it. In terms of and I'm going to go in reverse order. The first thing you talked about was some of the treatment out there, and we're going to come to that next. But where I want to start is with the parole board. The parole board actually falls within the Department of Corrections. The people that are on the parole board, it's a board like any other in the state in which the governor's made appointments. So if you have concerns about that, I encourage you to get in touch with the Department of Corrections, and they can try and help you with that. But the piece that I'd like to focus on more, and this is where I'm going to kick it over to Suzanne, is that one of the things that SB 91 was designed to do was to have reinvestment, to get more treatment options out there in the communities. Because you talk about the need for somebody to get some sort of treatment for a substance abuse. And that's one of the key focuses of SB 91, is trying to get more of that treatment out there. And I don't memorize all those numbers, but Suzanne, can you talk a little bit more about the money?
Sure. Let me talk a little bit about the reinvestment piece, because this is something that really universally, even people who are a little concerned about criminal justice reform, they all agree that we could use more support and treatment for people who are coming out of prison or who are in the criminal justice system. And the idea behind this is, look, if we want them to stop offending, many of these people, we need to address the underlying problems in their lives that are causing them to engage in criminal behavior. Not that they're not responsible, not that they don't have personal responsibility, but they have problems. And to ignore those problems really is just sort of to cut off our nose to spite our face. So one of the most exciting things that are being funded right now, about $1 million this year, are things called reentry coalitions. What are they? Well, they are groups of typically nonprofits and others involved in the criminal justice system who get together in communities. And we've got them in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Mat-Su, Juneau, Kenai, and a new one in Nome. And they reach out to people who are just coming out of prison and get them off on the right track instead of on the wrong track. It turns out the commission had very interesting research in front of it, data from Alaska even, showing that when people, the week that a person gets out of prison is many times the week that they get off on the wrong foot and reoffend and go back to prison. I mean, you would think that having just gotten out of prison, a person would be pretty careful not to go back. Well, as it turns out, statistically, that is that they're more likely to reoffend.
Vulnerable
to reoffend earlier than later. Mm-hmm. So the idea is, can we get these people, bring them in, figure out what they need to do, coordinate with their parole probation officers, and get them hooked up with treatment, with jobs, with GED training.
Housing
is actually a big part that they're trying to bring in, these reentry coalitions. So there was funding for that, as I mentioned, $1 million, and more is in the budget this year. Another really important thing that was funded, $2 million, is violence prevention. So a lot of the violent crime in Alaska is really assaultive behavior. We have a lot of domestic violence, as everyone knows. And so that money went to a victims organizations that serve victims and organizations that put out programs to prevent domestic violence. Some people may have heard of the Green Dot program. Boys to Men is another one. There are a number of and these are evidence-based programs. That's really important. These are programs that have been shown to have positive effects. So we're being very careful where we're putting our money. We don't want to put our money in programs unless they are shown, they've been shown in other places to have positive effects. So that's the victim, the violence prevention. Substance abuse is a big one, and there's $2 million that was just awarded a couple of months ago, and that's actually really exciting. That's going to go to a sobering center in Fairbanks, to residential substance abuse treatment in Kenai, and in the Valley in Palmer, it will go to opioid treatment. Organization there was funded for that. And that will be $6 million over the next 3 years. And also there was money for substance abuse treatment programs within the Department of Corrections. So we are still, you know, some people still need to be incarcerated. And when they're there, they should receive treatment if they need it. So the idea is, and that was, again, $1 million for that. So the other part of the reinvestment that hasn't come online yet is a pretrial services division, and that would be a division of the Department of Corrections that will help people who are released on bail to stay on the right track and remain in compliance with the law while they wait for their case to be resolved. So there is quite a bit of reinvestment money. It amounts to about $98 million over the next 10 years, I believe. So and that money is out there, and it's working for Alaskans right now.
That's great. I mean, that's one of the things that you're hopeful for, because we know oftentimes people in jail have mental health problems or addiction problems, or maybe their crime was because they had an addiction. And if we never treat that baseline issue, you know, so that's encouraging. So the money some of that money is already out.
Correct.
So that's great. Diane, did you have any other questions, or did that help?
That certainly starts the discussion, and I really appreciate this topic.
Thanks a lot, Diane. We appreciate your call. I'm wanting to remind people, if they just dialed in, we've had a lot of callers, and so we haven't really had – we've been responding to calls. But I think the calls are good because it shows where people have questions about SB 91. They've heard something. They're not sure if it's true, and that's why we've got these experts on the radio to answer those questions and also talk about the ambitions for the bill. So we actually need to take a little break. So you're listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, and when we come back, I'll reintroduce our guests and give you the phone numbers again.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. This show today is hosted with Elaine Andrews, Judge Elaine Andrews, and myself. And our guests are Suzanne DiPietro of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission and John Skidmore, Director of the Criminal Division of the Alaska Department of Law. And we have been talking about SB 91, and we welcome your calls. I feel like we've been answering some questions here that people really do need to have answered. They hear things. We have folks here who can actually tell you what the objectives of the bill are, if things are covered by this bill or not, what some of the suggested changes in the legislature are ongoing now. So I'm going to throw out our numbers one more time, and then we will go back to the discussion. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8433. Statewide, the number is 1-888-353-5752. And again, we welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So what did we not cover yet? I'm trying to think. Something that, before we move on to other callers, you know, we talked about the goals, sort of changing the rate of recidivism and also effectively spending money. But there's five ways we're planning to do that. And we got into one of them, reducing the barriers to reentry, like housing. You know, that first week when you're out of jail, how do you land on your feet if you don't have a job? Those kinds of things. So there was also strengthening probation and parole to reduce recidivism. But this one I think is really interesting, prioritizing prison space for individuals convicted of serious violations. I think anybody would agree that you want people who are dangerous away from us, people who are not dangerous, and we're spending a lot of money to keep them behind walls. Should we look at that? I mean, I think that's a fundamental thing here. And I think one of the stats I read in the report was 75% of the people in jail are there for nonviolent crime. Does that sound right?
That is a stat that they put out there. It's one of those things we always want to make sure that people understand what we mean when we say nonviolent.
Good. That's great.
And so in the statutes, they're broken into different sections. And Alaska Statute 1141 deals with crimes against persons, which is assaults, murders, sexual assaults, sexual abuse of a minor, robbery, kidnapping, those sorts of things. Those are all considered the, quote, violent crimes. But the nonviolent crimes can be things that involve a felon in possession of a weapon, can be shooting a weapon when you're intoxicated, it can be arson, it can be burglary. So there's a lot of other things that some members of the public might look at and say, well, wait a minute.
That feels violent.
That feels violent to me, but that is the way in which it's defined when we talk about these things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the important things to remember. But yes, that is an accurate statistic that the vast majority of people that are in prison actually end up in prison for what are classified as those nonviolent crimes, despite how mm-hmm. expansive that is.
And I think from the first half hour, you discussed, that there were felony B discussion going on, and mm-hmm. that some of those more serious ones would not be given the latitude that some others were given. So in other words, there's discretion, there's, you know.
You've hit on one of my favorite words, and Suzanne's going to laugh, but discretion within the criminal justice system is one of the keys to make the system work properly. There are so many different circumstances of a particular crime or of the person who's committed the crime and their backgrounds, and all of that combines in each and every case a unique situation.
Mm-hmm.
And courts really need the discretion to be able to look at those so the judge can say, well, this is someone that I think does need jail time, or this is someone that shouldn't have jail time mm-hmm. or should have little jail time. And having that discretion is one of those key components. And most of 91, I think, left judges with some discretion. One of the areas where it didn't leave them with a lot of discretion was a first-time Class C felony, and that's actually one of the changes that's being proposed in this year's SB or Senate Bill 54.
Why don't you explain a little bit about what that's going to change or propose to change?
Sure. So in talking about that discretion, the history of it was that previously a Class C felony, a first-time offender, and by first-time offender what I mean is they don't have a prior felony offense within about 10 years. So if you fall into that category, then there's a certain range that our statutes in Alaska say that that person could be sentenced to. Prior to SB 91, that range was 0 to 2 years. And what happened is that back in, I think it was 2006, we changed some of Alaska laws and moved those ranges up a little bit. And when we moved those ranges up, the reason we were doing that was to respond to a U.S. Supreme Court case and try and make the system work more effectively. They didn't mean to increase sentences when they did that. But in going back and looking at what happened to sentencing, the commission found that sentences all across the board had gone up. And so what 91 tried to do was to adjust it downward, those sentencing ranges. All of that makes sense. The one area that I think we found after we made the adjustments that left people with some real concerns was those first-time Class C felonies in which it was only probation that was possible. The judge didn't have discretion to send someone to jail for that first-time Class C felony unless there were other factors that were found. Mm-hmm. And so one of the changes that Senate Bill 54 now has proposed is to return some of that discretion to judges, not to the same degree as it was before, but still to have some discretion in there. And the debates have been, should it be 90 days? That's what the commission recommended. Should it be 0 to 120 days? Should it be up 0 to a year? What's the right number? And I don't know that there's one definitive right number, but people are looking at those options. Right now, Senate Bill 54 suggests that it be 0 to a year. Mm-hmm. Whether that's where the legislature ends up is yet to be seen.
All right. Susan, anything to add to that?
Well, I was just going to say one of the really interesting things that the commission learned when it studied what works in criminal justice is that for many offenders, for certain offenders, low-risk offenders, sending them to prison actually can make them worse rather than better. And so the commission's emphasis on trying to divert some nonviolent and low-level offenders from prison into other sanctions, you know, community-based supervision, the emphasis on that was really to let's take these low-risk people that we're mad at but not afraid of and try to divert them out of the prison system. And so and that's just a really interesting piece of research, and it's just very, very clear. There's really, people don't really argue with it, but it's hard to accept. It seems odd to people that that would be the case. And so that's the genesis of the thinking behind, you know, look, let's definitely send people to prison if that's going to improve the situation. But do we really need to send everyone to prison that we were sending to prison before? Or was it making them recommit new offenses?
Or learn how to be a better criminal.
Well, that's exactly right. There's a sort of a theory. It's called a schools of crime theory. So criminologists, I guess, study this. I'm not a criminologist, but I've read a lot. And they try to come up with theories for these surprising results. It is surprising to think that sending someone to jail would make them reoffend more rather than less. Mm-hmm. And so they study these things, and that's exactly what one of the most popular theories is, that they go to jail, they mix with higher risk people, they mix with more hardened criminals, they kind of make new friends that aren't, you know, that your mother wouldn't approve of, and they learn new things, and they also, to the extent that they might have had pro-social things going on for them on the outside, those social pro-social ties get disrupted. So maybe ties with family, maybe tie with a significant other, maybe housing gets disrupted, and so that's the combination of hanging out with people who are more hardened than you are and then disrupting all the pro-social, any pro-social forces that you may have had in your life kind of makes you worse.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. We're getting a lot of calls, so I'm just going to go ahead and move through some of them. I'd like to welcome Don onto Hometown Alaska. What's your question, Don?
Well, I was wondering what they do to deter repeat customers. What I'm getting at is there any type of punishment, or is it just room and board for them?
Okay, well, I don't think jail in itself is a warm and fuzzy place. So I don't know that, you know, people want to go back, but I don't know. Does anything Don says resonate with you, John?
Absolutely. There are sort of two categories in which we've looked at this. One is those Class C felonies that I talked about before, and I recognize what Suzanne talks about, that sometimes sending someone to jail can result in, look, we're not making them less likely to reoffend when they get out. But the flip side of that is this notion that sometimes there are those sorts of conduct that you say, yeah, but that's still deserving of something. Mm-hmm. Pointing a gun at somebody else, that's an assault in the third degree, a Class C felony that I think a lot of people would say, yeah, that's someone that we can't just kind of give a smack on the wrist or say we're going to put you on felony probation. There have to be other consequences. Mm-hmm. Arson, blowing up a car, that's actually a Class C felony. Do you think that person should only be on probation? Should they get some jail time? Distributing child pornography, again, a Class C felony. So you get the idea that there's just this mix of mm-hmm. what's the right thing and what's the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. But in terms of repeat offenders, the Class C felonies, we're really talking about that first offense. For repeat offenders, I think both what 91 did and now what 54 is looking at dealt with some low-level thefts. So instead of a felony, we're now talking about a misdemeanor, a theft that's under $250. And in 91, again, following the concept that Suzanne talked about, as they said, we don't think those people necessarily
necessarily need to be in jail. And so it changed the laws so that those people were placed on probation and weren't receiving jail sentences. But part of what we heard from the community, from law enforcement, from prosecutors that were talking to victims is, well, but for these thefts under $250, there's now this sense that some folks are being emboldened. They feel like it's just a free. They get to go in and take whatever they want, and there's not going to be a consequence. And so, again, that's one of the things that 54 has tried to address. It's trying to find that right balance between what Suzanne talks about, which is recognized as a problem. We don't want to teach somebody to do more criminal conduct. But at the same time, we can't just say, well, you took $250 or less, and we're going to kind of smack you on the wrist, give you a citation to show up in court. And by the way, there's the next store down the street. You can go and do that, and I'll give you another piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that 54 does is it provides the ability for judges to impose some jail in those circumstances. So it's trying to find the right balance, because I agree with Suzanne. We don't want to send everybody to jail, but you got to find that right balance. Mm-hmm.
And Suzanne, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to maybe say one thing about our sentencing structure in general that was true before 91 and is still true. We have what's called a presumptive sentencing structure. And so it is the basic structure of our sentencing that a person who commits an offense for the first time is the law provides for lesser penalties than the person who commits that same offense for a second time or a third time or a fourth time. And so that's a little bit of a sort of a broad idea. A lot of people don't understand our presumptive sentencing structure, and that's the way we've had that since the 80s. And the idea there is that you might want to give a break to the first time offender, but by the time they do it two or three or four times, you want to ratchet up the penalties,
the consequences. Right. All right. I'm going to move through a couple more questions. Elaine, I know you're here,
in. As I said, I'm taking a back seat today because I'm learning along with the callers.
Yes. Well, yes. At any point.
I have some thoughts, but I'm...
All right.
I'm actually more interested in the thoughts of the public that are calling in. So let's take another question.
Well, let's go to Harry. Welcome to Justice Alaska. What's your question?
Hi there. Well, it's a suggestion more than anything else. You know, we're the only state in the union that identifies our problem drinkers, but we haven't made it mandatory for every time somebody buys alcohol to check for the red stripe. And, you know, abusing alcohol is not a right. And it should be taken away when people have proven that they can't handle alcohol. So we need to continue to tighten up the red stripe law and make it mandatory when people buy alcohol in this state that they should have to show a state ID, whether it's a driver's license or just the picture ID, to prove that they're able to buy alcohol, or if they're from out of state, they should be able to, produce some sort of ID so that we can follow up and make sure that they're not just showing us a passport or a military ID when they've already been restricted. Because I hear that there's...
So, Harry, let's get to your question. What is your question?
I would like to follow up and put into the bill a mandatory check for the red stripe on any purchase of alcohol.
Would you like to address that, John?
So just so people understand, on anyone's driver's license, I don't remember if it was part of SB 91. I think there was something in 91 about this, but it was something that also predated 91. And that is that the driver's license, kind of like the way we've changed it to tell you when it's a minor, how it's vertical instead of horizontal. There's a red stripe that is put around the person's photo so that it alerts distributors or sellers of alcohol when there's someone that would have a prohibition. So that's what that red stripe talks about. And, checking for IDs is certainly one of those things that we try to encourage in a number of our laws and regulations.
It's not an SB 91 necessarily.
There was one piece in 91 that I think talked about trying to encourage the use of the red stripe, but the concept of getting people to check for that, well, that's the same thing as trying to get people to check a license to determine whether or not you're of age to purchase alcohol to begin
with. Sure. So I'm going to go to Maxine. Hi, Maxine. You're on Justice Alaska.
Thanks so much for taking my question. So our group is the Community United for Safety and Protection. We're Alaska's sex worker group, sex trafficking victims, and our allies. And so my question is about, you know, how it is that supposedly the commission is doing evidence-based recommendations. And my concern is about this recommendation that the commission made based on, you know, what John Skidmore made about repealing a piece of SB 91 that said that two prostitutes working together can't be charged with sex trafficking each other. And why you're making that recommendation, what evidence are you making that recommendation to be removed, and it's being removed in SB 54, and you're putting in some additional language in SB 54 that, too, doesn't have any research. So are you making decisions based on real research? And if so, can I have access to it? Because I want to make sure you're not making recommendations based on your own moral judgments.
Okay. So John says he will take that on. Okay, John.
So one of the things that Suzanne told us early on was that everything that ended up in SB 91 was not a recommendation that came out of the commission. And there was a part of SB 91 that changed some laws related to sex trafficking. There was no research into that. There was no evidence base that was being used for that. This was instead a concept that some legislators thought they wanted to make it easier for two prostitutes to be able to work together to provide protection to one another when they were engaged in those prostitution activities. And if that's the goal that the legislature had, that's a policy decision they get to make. But what we looked at is that in the changes that were made, we found that actually the way the law was written, it went beyond just that notion and actually created a loophole for people that were engaged in other legitimate types of sex trafficking. And so what we've recommended is repealing those provisions that had that problem, but adding in some new language that now tries to address the original problem that was identified. So I really appreciate the work that she's done, and I know that there are folks out there that have the points of view about what should be happening with prostitution. I don't express my own personal views on those things. My job as a lawyer is simply to give legal advice to both the legislature and the governor's mm-hmm. office.
I think it's good to point out, though, that the legislature did pass this and did have influence over, you know, pieces of it. So
sure.
They were in a position to put something in that they felt strongly about.
Right. And this is Suzanne. And I just might add that the organization that she represents has been very engaged with the commission and has made lots of public comments. And I want to let folks know that the commission, its meetings are all public. There's a website that has a lot of information that all of the studies that the commission relied on, data from Alaska, data from nationally. It has this meeting schedule for the commission. I just want to encourage members of the public to get involved and look at some of that information. And you know, the commission really, we have a public comment period at every single meeting. And the commission welcomes the involvement of anyone who has a point of view.
Mm-hmm. I will make sure we've got that link on our website. I know I have SB 91, SB 54, and some of the news coverage of the bill, but I'm not sure I have that, and I think that's really important. I'll make sure we add it right after the show. So I'm just thinking, what haven't we covered that you think we should be dealing with? Because we have a little break in the calls, so go ahead, Suzanne.
Well, one thing that we haven't talked about is probation supervision, and that was so we like to think of SB. Some of us think of SB 91 in kind of three chunks. The first chunk is some of these sentencing changes that we've been talking about a lot. The second chunk is changes to how people are supervised on probation and parole. And then the third chunk I briefly alluded to, which is changes in how we deal with people who are waiting, who've been charged with a crime but haven't yet been convicted. So the probation and parole part just went into effect in January. As I mentioned before, what we call the pretrial part hasn't gone into effect yet, so we don't need to really talk about that. But one of the interesting things about that the commission learned about how many resources were being used is that it found that a lot of prison beds were being taken up by people who had been released on probation or parole and who were back in for either making technical violations of their parole or committing new offenses. And a technical violation is something like, it can be a number of things, but it could also include, you know, not going to an appointment with your probation officer. It could include using drugs or alcohol when you're not supposed to. So the commission looked at, hey, how could Alaska do a better job at supervising these folks who are out and trying to, again, get them into good habits, get them hanging out with the right people, get them engaged in pro-social activities, and sanction them effectively when they don't. So one of the things that the bill did is it encouraged the required the Department of Corrections to create a new ways of sanctioning administratively probationers who are not on the right track, and also new ways to reward them or incentivize them for doing the right things. So it's the carrot and the stick. It's very important. We use a lot of sticks in the criminal justice system. Sticks are pretty easy. Carrots are harder, but they're very effective. I mean, that's the therapeutic court model, is that encouraging people to do the right thing and giving them rewards when they do, sometimes very small rewards, for example, praise, is really kind of astonishingly effective. So that was one piece. And then also the law sort of changed a little bit the way probation violations are dealt with. So it used to be that a probation officer who saw that the person that they were supervising wasn't doing the right thing had either made a technical violation or committed a new offense even, would have to bring them back to court. There would have to be an adjudication, and that still has to happen. But the bill kind of streamlines a little bit how that can happen by making set amounts of time that a person can be sanctioned in jail. So the idea is that if a person who's on probation does something wrong, that the sanction will be swift, it will be certain, and it will be proportionate. And before, the commission found that the sanctions were not really very swift and not really very certain, actually, and sometimes not proportionate. So that hopefully will be a change that will cause the number of probationers who need to be returned to jail for lengthy periods of time, hopefully will cause that to go down a little bit, help them be more successful.
You know, I'm wondering about the research that went behind SB 91. How often does the Department of Law, the Department of Corrections, have that opportunity to look and see how are we doing? I mean, is that built into the system? It seems like it was a big effort for SB 91. A lot of surprising information came out. So is it that we just haven't had the time to look?
Well, you know, interesting, the legislature, it was a lot of time and effort to gather all this information. And sometimes we had only studies from other states and not our own studies. We tried to use our own studies when we could, but we didn't have them all the time. One of the great things that the legislature has done now is to require the commission to collect and provide this kind of data. So a key piece of this law is that the commission will be monitoring and reporting to the legislature and to the public what's happening as a result of these changes. Are we doing better? Are we doing worse? Mm-hmm. And that's really important. I'll let John talk about whether that was a helpful exercise for his agency or not.
I would say it absolutely was. We have, within the last couple of years, changed the case management system, how it is we track our cases and what's going on with them, because we found the old one, something we'd had for 20-plus years, was outdated, antiquated, and we couldn't find the sort of data about how were we performing. We couldn't generate that out of that system. And so that's one of the things that we had looked at even before 91 came around. I found what's been going on in the process and the data that we want to collect and track it. I think it's a fantastic idea. I think it's an idea that's long overdue for the state of Alaska, trying to bring some consensus or uniformity to looking at the entire state and gathering this information from all around, from law enforcement, from prosecution, from the courts, from corrections, look at it in this total package and try and figure out how things are operating. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is one of the most exciting pieces about SB 91, is that we are going to be trying to evaluate the system from that data perspective and see what it yields for us. We don't know yet, because we're still in the process of gathering lots of data.
Mm-hmm. I assume that the commission stays functioning now for a while, because this is a long process, or
five
not?
Years.
5 years. So we just, I mean, they started in 2014, so they go through, 2019, something like that?
It was re-upped in SB 91 for an additional 5 years.
So 2021.
So there you go.
Okay. So they're around, and that's part of the not oversight, but the evaluation, I guess the ongoing evaluation. I've got an email, so why don't we go ahead and take Barbara's email. She says, rather than jail time for light offenders, I would like to see restitution to the victims, perhaps double or triple. Mm-hmm. This way, the offender's not encouraged to continue to offend. We're just talking about carrots, sticks. Monetary compensation or personal service would be options for both parties to consider for restitution. How about that?
Restitution is a huge issue within the criminal justice system, and certainly one of the things that we at the Department of Law recognize that we want to try to be doing more with. So one of the ways that we're looking at doing that is through a concept called pretrial diversion. Instead of taking someone who's stolen something from somebody else, we would look at that situation and say, okay, we want you to pay back whatever it is that you've stolen, and then maybe there's something else that we would require, community work service, that the concepts that she describes are mm-hmm. appropriate ones. And you do those things successfully, and then maybe we don't even have to convict you of that crime. What's most important is trying to make those victims whole. So that's certainly something that I think we're looking at in the criminal justice system within the Department of Law specifically, about how can we try and improve those things. Restitution is always been a difficult nut to crack because so many of these people who commit the crimes don't have the money to pay back for the damage they've caused, whether through theft or just the property damage or the injuries caused to somebody else. But trying to focus on that restitution up front is certainly going to be one of the focuses mm-hmm. that we're looking at going forward. And mm-hmm. I think it's a great point, and I really appreciate the email.
You know, and actually, if I might interrupt, just to add that the commission actually recently released a report on victim restitution, because that's one of the areas that the legislature was also very interested in. Some interesting, the commission went and looked at, you know, how much restitution is paid. And it is true, unfortunately, that we could do a lot better on getting victim restitution repaid. But one of the most interesting statistics to me, or things that we found out when we looked into it, is it's amazing. Many offenders will make voluntary payments. So the main way of recouping victim restitution is through garnishment of the PFD. But many offenders, we found, do make voluntary payments, sometimes very small ones. But many restitution amounts are actually quite small, under $1,000. So an offender who is willing to pay $50 a month could actually, over time, make that payment. And I think the person who emailed had a very good point, because making restitution payments is hard, and it's something that offenders should be required to do to sort of make the victim whole and to reintegrate themselves into the community.
Mm-hmm. I was, when we met beforehand and we were talking about what we wanted to accomplish during the show, I thought that we have about 2 minutes left, so I just wanted to get this in. You know, people are seeing some property crime, and they're thinking somehow that this is related to SB 91, and so I just kind of, I guess we talked about it in terms of sort of a perfect storm. The state is out of money; it's trying to balance its budget. You know, we're in a recession. There's a lot of things going on.
The opioid crisis, right?
Yes, and so go ahead, John. I'm just going to hand it to you.
Well, I think the term that you used is one that I would go back to: a perfect storm. That's actually the phrase that the Attorney General Johnna Lindemuth used in her op-ed piece. And what it talks about is reduction in budgets, fewer prosecutors means we have less ability to prosecute crimes. The opioid crisis, all those things happening at once, just makes it really difficult to deal with. But there's a lot of those causes that are not related to 91.
Right. That's an important takeaway from today. So as you can hear the music, we're out of time. But I'm glad we got to mention that, because that seemed important yesterday. I'd like to thank my co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. Thank you for being here and starting us off. Suzanne DiPietro with the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, and John Skidmore with the Department of Law. And of course, all our listeners and callers today. Charles Warforth will be back as your Hometown Alaska host next week. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer today. Thanks for joining us on Hometown Alaska, Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.